these guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, and 720 WGN.
And it's John Williams. How are you? In for Steve Bertrand. Steve will be back next week. I'll be on the air till 3. You normally hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 and Saturdays from 10 to noon. Couple quick programming notes. On Saturday from 10 to noon, we'll be sharing the microphone with the afternoon and morning shows here as they join us from Arizona as we get ready for White Sox baseball. And also, like me on Facebook. I'm WGN King John on Facebook. We did post, we just told Bill and Wendy about this a minute ago, a series that I just recently discovered on Netflix, a docuseries. It's a 10-parter. It's called Drive to Survive. I don't care or know anything about Formula One driving, but this series is so compelling and fun and visually awesome that you got to watch it. The rules are you have to start your post with, "Oh my God, you guys, you've got to watch," and you get two sentences and you're already playing the game. "Oh my God, John, you have to watch The Killing on Netflix. Dark murder mystery with lots of twists. Only 3.5 seasons, so good." The next one is about another show, but it doesn't begin with, "Oh my God, you guys, you've got to watch, so I won't share that." That's the rules. We'll talk a little bit about some of the things that are going on in that space, by the way, with Apple and with Netflix and with streaming, because that is changing on the show today. But let's begin with a conversation with John Najarian, the contributor at CNBC and the co-founder of Najarian Family Office. Hi, John. It's John Williams. How are you?
Oh, my God, John. I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Oh, shoot. You're disappointing me now. I thought we were going to get one. Oh, my God, John, you've got to watch. What does John Najarian watch when he sits back and dives into a series right now?
Other than Game of Thrones and Billions, nothing. Those are the only ones I watch.
how unsurprising. So
exactly.
There was just a piece in the New York Times style section of all places this weekend about Billions and how, you know, they've got to get it right. What is, like, you know what a millionaire looks like, but what does a billionaire look like? What clothes do they wear? What does their house look like? Stuff like that. And they say they actually have it pretty good. Billionaires, they said, don't dress up as much as millionaires because they're billionaires. Who cares? You know what I mean?
That's a fact. I'm lucky enough to know several, including a number that own sports teams and things. And I can tell you, the clothes are nice, but they are the same clothes that you'd buy anywhere that those guys wear, mainly sweaters and nice slacks, but not a lot of suits.
Yeah.
And certainly not fancy shoes, really.
So if I was sitting next to a billionaire at a Starbucks, I might not notice.
Easily, you might not notice. And that's the way they like that, by the way.
Speaking of billions, so what's happening with the market today? Our Steve Alexander just said a minute ago that they're, what is it, trading on the rumor that because of this China news, the market's taking it's not below the open today, but it's going down. What's going on?
Well, it was up about 170 points. News came out, or leaked at least, that Representative Lighthizer, that's for the U.S. trade delegation, said that there were some terms that were being renegotiated before we even have a deal. And that's not surprising. I mean, we heard China say this morning a ludicrous they implied that they might cut back on Boeing 737 MAX purchases. And even though it's not ludicrous that somebody might do that, somebody in China's position doesn't have a choice. By that, I mean that they're 25% of the aviation world right now. They can't get enough jets out of either Boeing or Airbus to meet their needs. And that's why they pretty much split them up. So that's more of a positioning or a negotiating tool, but it's not really something that most of us believe in. And who knows, maybe that's what hit the tape later, you know, 4 or 5 hours later, because I don't think that the market is really downplaying China as a big active participant in the markets. I think they're doing the opposite. They're thinking China's going to be making a comeback in the very near future.
I'm sorry, but then why would it be taking a dip today?
All we did was dip. I mean, you know, I know 100 points between friends, John, it seems like a lot, but in the market, with the market near 26,000 for the Dow, 100 points is nothing. So we were up 170, we sold down to being up 8, and now we're right back up towards, what are we up, 102 points. So I'd say that that's more noise than it is directional.
So much attention on these China talks, though, and I'm not even sure what the thrust of them is anymore. It's about tariffs. Is that still what they're debating? I mean, what's the import of that stuff?
The two main things are really the intellectual property. It's not so much theft, but it's the forced sharing of intellectual property if you want to do business within China and with Chinese companies. That's one part. The other part, as you accurately said, is tariffs. And they had them on our goods. We didn't like it. The president lashed out at them for that and started ratcheting up tariffs on their goods coming into the country. And because our consumers are wealthier than theirs, we've still continued to buy those goods even with tariffs on them, whereas they can't afford our goods with the tariffs on them. So it hasn't helped trade, but it certainly brought them to the table about negotiating.
Yeah. One last question about that, then I want to move on to this Netflix and Apple TV story. But is anybody even in China able to keep them from intellectually stealing U.S. property?
Well, that's a good point. I think most of us would believe, John, that China is acting not as an independent company like Boeing acts, but as a company or as a as one unit. In other words, the government, what it wants is what China and Chinese companies do.
So they could. So they could impose that.
They could, if they agree to that. But in other words, when an executive from China gets held because their chips are used as listening devices in every computer distributed around the world, if China elected to ban that practice, it would stop immediately. It's not an individual's decision. It's the Chinese Communist Party's decision, I believe.
Netflix will not join Apple TV's new service. I guess I will stream Apple products or products Apple has acquired, and I won't see Netflix products on my Apple stream. Is that the upshot here?
That is. They wanted to take a cut, of course, just like they do for everything in their Apple store, John. They take about a 30% cut of anything sold through that Apple store. And their idea for streaming is they might try to do something like that to offset costs and to turn it into a profit center. Netflix said no thank you, and they're walking away from that. They also probably view them more as a competitor now, not just a carrier, not just a platform. So that's another reason that they would do that.
But there's so much good content on Netflix. I want to keep my Netflix account. But now I may want some of the stuff in the Apple universe, so I'm going to maybe subscribe to them as well. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, that's what Apple's counting on. Again, I think that many of us will basically look at the offerings and say, I don't need another $9, $10, $12, whatever it is a month
right
on top of my bills.
Right.
I certainly think it helps the cord cutting that goes on from cable, but I think they still need the pipe into your home for cable for your Wi-Fi, and that will then be the access point. And the question is, how much are you spending on your cable bill for the channels? And I think that is what Apple and everybody else is going after. Hulu, Apple, AT&T with Time Warner, and even Xfinity going after that market very hard right now.
I wonder down the road how many then media bills I will have coming into me. You know, I'll pay a Netflix bill. Maybe I'll play an Apple bill. Maybe I'll still subscribe to Comcast just to get my content. I wonder how many debits I'll have for my checking account.
Well, and here's just a quick thought, John. The cable bill is something that's heavily taxed in every jurisdiction. So if all of a sudden we all start cutting the cord and that $100 bill disappears and instead you're doing an a la carte of $15 yeah. here, $20 there,
yeah.
they're not getting taxes on that because the jurisdictions don't have access to
really?
That, at least at this point. Yep, that's why so many people that subscribe to Dish and DirecTV find that their bills are lower, because the local jurisdictions don't get taxes on that. And that's why they've threatened to use Google Earth and other things to look around for where those dishes are so they could try to collect for them.
John Najarian's a contributor at CNBC, co-founder of the Najarian Family Office. Listen, John, nice to talk to you. I'm out of time, but we'll look forward to your conversation with Steve next week.
Thank you very much, John. Have a great show.
Heather Haddon is a food and farm reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She joins us now on WGN Radio to talk a little bit about the new entries in the food delivery space. Heather, it's John Williams. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Your piece is headlined, "The Delivery Wars." It starts with the story of somebody getting food delivered in Anchorage, Alaska, which is ambitious, isn't it?
Yeah, so these services that really started in the big cities, including Chicago, Grubhub is located here, have really spread all across the country into suburbs and smaller cities as they've tried to establish more growth to please their investors and as more people, consumers, have gotten interest in these services. So we looked at both grocery delivery and restaurant delivery and explored some of the growth happening here and the challenges economically for these companies.
What do you mean, challenges?
So it is very expensive to do this, and both for the restaurants and the grocers who hire these third-party services to perform this service for them. So again, like the Grubhub, Postmates, Instacarts of the world, they take a hefty cut of the profits from the service to actually do the delivery, so to actually run the online portal, to hire the drivers, gig economy drivers, to shuttle this around. But then there are also costs, for these services to perform that, and that's why they're really trying to show growth for their investors so they can keep attracting investments to keep these services going. And then, of course, there's costs to users. So you and me have to pay for this. This is not free, even though a lot of them are running promotions. Eventually, you are going to pay a fee for these services.
We're talking about restaurant delivery and or grocery store delivery?
Correct.
Yeah. And what's the biggest growth? Is it in the grocery store delivery, or is it because some restaurants have traditionally delivered anyway, pizza places, stuff like that, Jimmy John's. But then there are other services that will pick up the food from restaurants and deliver it to you, right?
Yeah, so that's, again, the Grubhub, Postmates type model. And what they're doing is they're bringing a lot more variety of delivery to people. So yeah, traditionally, like you said, it was pizza places, Chinese food, sandwiches, really simple things to transport, where it was, clearly established how you package up these goods and get it to people's homes. Now, this is adding a whole new complexity to it when you're delivering, pasta or salad or soups or milkshakes, things that are, complicated to deliver. The restaurants really have to spend time investing in that and make sure it's actually worth it for them to do it.
I'm not even sure it's always worth it for the brand's sake. We had the two best hamburgers made in Chicago, according to a reader's poll, or actually a reporter tasted 72 different hamburgers in Chicago over the course of a month. And then he bit a big story in the Tribune about who was first place and second place. We had those stores deliver their burgers to us, and with the reporter, we all sampled the best burgers in Chicago, which I'm sure are fantastic. But by the time they got here and we ate them, they weren't as good as they would have been in the restaurant. And now my experience with that brand is not as good as it would have been otherwise,
Yeah, and that's the real risk for these companies when they hire these third-party services to perform the delivery. It's kind of out of their hands once it leaves their restaurant. So they try to do their best in terms of investing in good packaging to keep it hot or keep it cold or from spilling. But once it leaves, there's only so much they can do, and often there are complaints about food being arriving cold.
And it may be, well, now that's another matter entirely, but it may be in the end of the day, consumers will say, I'm willing to pay more for food that isn't perfect for convenience's sake. There's no bad guy here. If you're willing to do that, more power to you. But I'm wondering if, in fact, these delivery schemes will exist 5 years from now. Is this a sort of testing period, or is this the way it's going to be forever and ever, do you think?
It is definitely a testing period. I think the question more is how many delivery services will there be rather than will there be delivery services at all. There's clearly a market for this. People really want the convenience of getting delivery, groceries and restaurants, delivery to their home. They're busy, they're stressed, they just want to be home with their families in the little time that they have, and they want this service bringing it to them. The question is, though, there's so many different services now all competing for market share, and it really, we are in a period where it's a lot of testing and learning, but eventually there'll probably be some consolidation of these companies.
Somewhere someone's mother is saying, but you're losing the value and the art of food preparation, kids. I hate to see it go this way, you know?
Yeah, and there certainly is going to be long-term impacts of this. You know, will we start to lose preparation skills? Will we also, you know, so generally restaurant food tends to be higher fat and higher calorie.
Higher salt.
So the question is, you know, will, you know, some analysts say that people are using more leftovers out of their delivery. So they're taking one delivery and turning it into multiple meals and maybe combining it with other foods that they prepare on their own. So that's kind of a mashup that we're starting to see as delivery just becomes more of a matter of fact of life. But certainly for younger consumers who just grow up on this stuff, they might not learn how to cook until they're much older.
And then it'll be too late. And then they'll wish they had those recipes and skills, but no, they won't, said someone's mother somewhere. Heather Haddon is a food and farm reporter at the Wall Street Journal. It's an interesting piece today and an interesting space to follow. Heather, thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Eric. This is John Williams in for Steve Bertrand. Steve's back next week. You normally can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 and Saturdays from 10 to noon. I'll go all the way till 3 today. On my Facebook page, like me, I'm WGN King John. I'm asking you to, in two sentences, tell me a show you've discovered that you would come up to me and say, oh my God, John, you've just got to watch. You only get two sentences, and your two sentences, the first one has to begin with that. And we're getting some fun hits on that, and you can be part of it too. WGN King John on Facebook. I started this because I discovered that series Drive to Survive, which is about Formula One driving. It's on Netflix. Who knew? I'm like, I'm not watching that. My son said, give it a try. It was one of those things where 30 minutes later, it says the next episode will start in 5 seconds. And you go, I got 5 seconds. And then the next thing you know, you've sat there for 4 hours. And it was fascinating. So we'll see what you are recommending and talk a little more about that in the 2 o'clock hour here on WGN Radio. Right now, Margaret Frisbee joins us, Executive Director of Friends of the Chicago River. Margaret, it's John. How are you today?
I'm terrific. How are you, John?
Good. How are the rivers? How is the river today?
Well, the river is recovering from its wild weekend and going back into its more natural state.
I've been paying attention to that because I watched them dye it on Saturday, and it still does have some of that green color. It's not as bright as it was on Saturday, of course, but it still does look a sort of Kelly green, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And again, that's all healthy and good, right? We don't have a problem with that?
Well, we're not big fans of dyeing the river green. We think it's a tradition that maybe one day people will change their minds about. And when we talk about a natural resource, we don't usually think we'll dye it bright green. So I know that people think it's a lot of fun, but over time, if you think about beavers and muskrats and turtles and fish, maybe we'll think of something new.
Do we know? I know this isn't why we called you today, but do we know what the impact of that is on the wildlife that does use the river?
Well, you know, we don't know. I know that Illinois EPA has not required a permit for the dyeing of the river to be green, but we do know from a public point of view, people perceive that the river is not as vital and alive as it is because they think who would ever dye Lake Michigan green, for example, right? And so it's a public relations thing more than almost anything else.
Well, you don't want to be on the wrong side of that fight. I mean, if you said, okay, we're not going to dye the river green, there'd be hell to pay for that, Margaret.
Well, you know what? We're not fighting it because there's things that are happening every day that are lots worse than that. And frankly, you know, we need to focus on those things.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that and the economic vitality around the river. What are you seeing today?
Well, you know, the river has really become the center of our community in a whole new way. And, you know, there's new mega developments along the river. There's new parks. There's all kinds of great things happening. And Friends of the Chicago River wants to make sure, as the riverfront redevelops, that we're considering it as a natural resource rather than a water feature or, as it used to be, a sewage canal.
I'm sorry, what's the difference? I mean, sewage canal is bad, but natural resource versus what? What's that distinction?
Well, it's a water feature. So, you know, if you're thinking about, as I said earlier, you know, the river is actually alive with wildlife, and it's, you know, there's 70 species of fish, there's beavers, muskrats, turtles, and we need to think about the river as a place that is a haven for them. They need to have habitat, they need shelter, food, you know, places to live and ways to be connected in between, you know, forest preserves and parks. And so both in-stream and on the bank, we see the river developing as a blue-green corridor of public open space. And what we mean by that is a place where there's, you know, great trails for terrific public access, but there's also real wildlife habitat. And it, you know, it'll pay us back in, you know, making our communities healthier, reducing stormwater and sewage pollution, air pollution, the urban heat island effect, all those kinds of things. And so we look at this as a collective quality of life benefit. At the same time, it helps wildlife.
I'm thinking of the Chicago River from the lake to maybe Wolf Point, where it branches off and goes north and south, and then maybe a short distance in either direction. Is that the section of the river we're talking about that could be a blue-green area, as you say?
Well, we're really looking at the full 156 miles, and so there's a lot of fun to be had on the Chicago Riverwalk. It's one of my favorite places to go, but if you're down there, what you realize is most of the Riverwalk has a hard concrete edge, and what we want to see is most of the river, you know, in the neighborhoods and in suburban areas, you know, outside of the immediate downtown, to consider what it would be like if it was natural open space as opposed to concrete and hardscape. So we've actually developed a new economic return on investment study that analyzes what the benefit of developing the river as a blue-green corridor would be. And we found that for every dollar invested in making natural open space along the river, we'd get $1.77 in return.
How do you figure that?
Well, what happens is we evaluated, well, we worked with the University of Wisconsin Fiscal and Economic Research Center, and they used existing scientific studies that look at property values and the benefits of being adjacent to green infrastructure, which is, you know, infrastructure that instead of being gray, hard, you know, pipes and tunnels, it's infrastructure that allows rainwater to fall into the ground. And what they looked at was nature-based solutions. So that means native plants, you know, open areas where water can infiltrate the ground. And what they found is everywhere that the studies looked at where people were adjacent to that kind of really green open space, their property values increased by 5% over 15 years, which then increases their personal wealth. And in Cook County, what we found was on residential properties within 1,500 feet of the river, the average property value would increase by over $13,000.
Is the enemy of that, though, developers who say, no, I want to put a restaurant with a deck or a cement patio right up to the bank of the river, the way we see downtown?
Well, you know, John, that is a terrific question, and that is partly why we did this study, is because we believe you can do both. There is certainly room along the riverbank to have wonderful places where people can dine outside. I know in Chicago the season isn't that long, and we don't want to keep people away from the river. We want them nearby. And so what we're advocating is that you consider the riverbanks and make sure that they're natural and protected and enhanced so that they're healthy, and then up on the, you know, in the top of the bank, you know, have trails and restaurants, all kinds of things. But we're certain we can do both, and it will pay us back to do it.
Physically, does that mean just creating a buffer space between the shore and these developments? Is that what it would look like?
Yeah, so right now, the city of Chicago, for example, requires a 30-foot setback for all riverfront development. So every time a new development happens along the river or something redevelops, they have to provide 30 feet. So that 30 feet is from the top of the bank. So you can restore the riverbank, have 30 feet that is naturalized, and that doesn't mean people can't be there. It just means you're considering that there's native plants and trees and shrubs at the same time that you're, you know, wending trails through. And it's really, you know, I think it's something that we will see more frequently. It's certainly happening in other cities, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Houston. They're all looking at this kind of investment, which improves our resiliency and improves quality of life and creates connections, you know, for natural wildlife movement and for people to enjoy the river.
Where can people read more about this, Margaret?
Well, we've launched our new study last week, and we've posted it on our website at chicagoriver.org. And it's a great pamphlet that talks all about, you know, the research we found, the jobs that we would create, the improved wildlife habitat, and then some of the studies, the case studies of other cities, so we can see what other people are doing and how successful they have been.
As much as we love the river around here, we should pay attention to this. Margaret Frisbee is the executive director of Friends of the Chicago River. Thanks for your time, Margaret.
It's my pleasure, John. You take care.
Interesting stuff there. Okay, it's 12:46 now. This is WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. All right, guys, what did I tell you about Chicago's marijuana business? It's a hotbed. Just look here. Cresco Labs is a Chicago-based operation that just bought out Vidacan, a Florida-based operator, for $120 million. That's two major market movers expanding into double-digit markets essentially overnight. But the more of these we see, the more likely it puts pressure on the ways that state categorize the substance. So the movement of the market is doing its job. Now it's up to the states to see where they stand on it and decide if they want it or not. But outside of Chicago, up in Lamont, something big is also going on. Argonne National Lab is just casually building the world's biggest and fastest supercomputer to help solve the world's problems and analyze data at lightning speed. $500 million from the Department of Energy is backing the project. But the tough thing is that the computer won't even be finished until 2021. It's going to take more than Control-Alt-Delete to reset this computer. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you, Steve Alexander. 12:54 WGN. John Williams looking at his brackets right now. I'm not alone. In fact, a recent survey said that 70% of bosses say that their staff is doing this is actually a productive thing. It's at least good for morale. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening to businesses because of March Madness with Marilyn Byrd, district president at Robert Half here in Chicago. Am I reading that right, Marilyn?
You are. Hi, John. Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you on the show. It's very timely. And I was just telling my producer that four of the biggest days in America on the calendar for a lot of people are Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They get so amped up about this. It is so much fun. And they talk about it and they do it at work, don't they?
They absolutely do. My favorite part of the survey, though, was Chicago ranking second out of, I think it was 28 cities as far as biggest sports celebrators.
Well, we have so few opportunities.
Surprise, surprise.
That when we do get the chance, I guess we go all in. But I mean, what happens? People are is the fear that people will not be doing their jobs so many minutes a day because they're too busy doing brackets, talking about brackets, filling them out, that sort of thing?
This survey actually is pointing out the positives of the workplace. It seems like the workplace has shifted a lot over the last few years where they're embracing it. They know people are thinking about it, so different workplaces are trying to bring it in and make it part of the workday without becoming a distraction. And the survey says that's good for employee morale, and it might even be a productivity boost in some organizations.
Should employers care if there's wagering involved? I suppose there is.
This particular survey didn't address that. It's not something that we would advocate. Really, more of the focus is on the bonding, the fun, the team spirit that can come from something like that.
Most businesses I've been associated with, the employees are doing this, but it's never from the top down. It's somebody in the newsroom or somebody in accounting that does it. You would suggest that actually the managers consider issuing a company poll. Is that right?
Absolutely. And this isn't the first survey that's pointing to this type of activity. There's so much going on in the workplace right now where lines are blurring, trying to make work more fun. They're trying to do things to keep employees engaged. Any little bit that can bring some of the outside life into the workplace really seems to be a hit.
I'll let you go, Marilyn, but one last thing about this then. So in March it's this, but then would you suggest employers should consider what is the April, May, June, July, et cetera, equivalent of that?
Anything that can foster camaraderie and help workers bond is definitely going to be good for morale.
Marilyn Byrd's the district president at Robert Half here in Chicago. Marilyn, good luck with your brackets, and thanks for your time.
Thanks, John. Bye-bye.